Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the incredible engineering of your own body. We're talking about human anatomy and biomechanics, decoding the very language your body speaks every single moment.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff.
From how your muscles literally pull you through the world to why you stand the way you do, we're going to give you a shortcut, hopefully, to understanding the internal blueprint that powers every move you make.
And what's so fascinating here is how these seemingly complex terms, they actually describe the elegance and, well, the efficiency with which your body operates every single day.
Right.
Understanding these fundamentals isn't just for, academics. It's about gaining an everyday awareness of your movement, your posture,
Totally.
truly appreciating the engineering marvel that is the human form.
Absolutely. And we've got a stack of sources here. It's like a comprehensive manual, really, full of those nuggets of knowledge we love to explore. Our mission is to arm you with insights that, well, might just change how you feel and interact with your own body. So let's jump right in.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the body as a remarkably sophisticated system of levers.
Okay.
So every movement you make, right, from wiggling a finger to running a marathon, it starts with your muscles and how they connect to your bones.
Fundamentally, yes.
Think of it this way. A muscle has an origin. That's its attachment point on a fixed, stable bone.
The anchor point, basically.
Exactly, the anchor. And then there's the insertion, which is its attachment on the bone that actually moves.
Right, the one that gets pulled.
Yeah. So when you want to perform a specific action, a prime mover, or sometimes called an agonist, takes the lead.
The main muscle for the job.
Right. And just like in a well-choreographed dance, there are also antagonist muscles that gently oppose or resist that movement, making sure everything is smooth and controlled. All this incredible action pivots around your joints, which are essentially the points where two bones meet.
The articulation points.
And here's a key concept. These joints aren't just meeting points. They are the fulcrums, the pivot points for all that powerful muscle action.
Precisely. And if we zoom out a bit, you can really appreciate the mechanical brilliance here. Your body essentially uses a system of levers.
Well, livers, okay. Like in physics class.
Sort of, yeah. Think of a lever as a simple machine, a device pivoted on a fixed point, that fulcrum we just mentioned,
Right.
designed to lift or move something. In the body, your muscles generate a linear force, a pull,
Okay.
and these levers convert that linear force into a rotary force. That's what creates the rotational movement we see at our joints.
Ah, I see. Linear to rotary.
It's all about creating movement efficiently.
So, how many different kinds of these simple machines are we actually using inside?
Well, your body primarily employs three main classes of levers.
Three. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's visualize each one. First, a first-class lever.
Okay.
Here, the fulcrum your joint sits right between the force from your muscle and the load, or the resistance you're moving.
Okay, fulcrum in the middle, like a seesaw.
Exactly like a seesaw, or scissors, or even a crowbar. What's fascinating is that this type of lever can give you either strength or speed, depending on where that fulcrum is positioned relative to the force and load.
Ah, versatile.
Very. In your body, a great example is the joint between your skull and your first neck vertebra, the atlas, or C1.
Okay, up top.
Right. When you nod your head, your neck muscles pull on the back of the skull. That's the force. Your head itself is the load. And that joint, C1, is the fulcrum right in the middle.
Makes sense. Nodding is a first-class lever action. What's next?
Moving to the second-class lever. Here, the load, the resistance, is positioned between the fulcrum and the force.
Load in the middle this time.
Correct. The classic example is a wheelbarrow. The wheel is the fulcrum at the front.
Right.
The load you're carrying is in the middle, and you apply the force upwards at the handles at the back.
Okay, got it.
The main advantage of a second-class lever is strength. It multiplies your force.
Strength. Okay, where do we see that in the body?
Think about when you stand on your tiptoes.
Okay, calf raise.
Exactly. Your ankle joint complex, specifically the ball of your foot on the ground, acts as the fulcrum. Your body weight is the load pressing down through your leg bones, and your calf muscles pull upwards via your Achilles tendon. That's the force, the powerful movement, right? Lifting your entire body weight.
Yeah, definitely feels strong. Okay, so that's two. What's the third?
Finally, we have the third-class lever. This is where the force from your muscle is positioned between the fulcrum your joint and the load or resistance.
Force in the middle now.
Force in the middle. So, unlike the first two, the primary advantage of a third-class lever is speed of movement, range of motion, rather than brute strength.
Speed over strength, like
And
Rick
what?
Dave.
Imagine using tweezers. The pivot is at the back. That's the fulcrum. Your fingers apply force in the middle.
Right.
and the tiny load, whatever you're grabbing, is at the tip, or even like an inside car door handle.
Okay, I can picture that.
And here's where it truly gets insightful. The vast majority of our everyday movements, most limb movements anyway, are actually third-class levers.
Really? Most of them?
Most of them. Think about lifting something with your hand. Your elbow joint is the fulcrum.
Okay.
Your biceps muscle attaches just below the elbow, providing the force in the middle, and the weight in your hand is the load at the end.
Wow. So our body prioritizes speed and range for most things.
It seems that way, doesn't it? It suggests that for many daily tasks, reaching, grabbing, fine motor skills, efficient speed, and a wide range of motion are often more, perhaps evolutionarily beneficial, than just raw power.
That's a really interesting design principle.
It's a profound design choice.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider mechanical advantage.
Mechanical advantage. What's that exactly?
It's essentially a ratio that measures how much a lever multiplies the force you put in, how efficient it is. The first and second class levers typically have a better mechanical advantage for generating force.
Right, the strength ones.
Exactly. But the dominance of third class levers in our body highlights this elegant trade-off. We sacrifice some potential raw strength at the muscle attachment point for a much greater range and speed of motion out at the end of the limb.
Ah, okay. Less force needed close to the joint gives you faster movement further away.
Precisely. This allows for incredibly quick, adaptable, and precise movements. Think about throwing a ball, playing piano, any of those fine, fast actions. It's invaluable.
Fascinating how simple physics underpins such complex biology. Okay, so now that we've decoded the fundamental machinery of movement with these levers, let's zoom out and understand the GPS your body uses to navigate space, the language of anatomical planes and directions. So what does this all mean for describing how our bodies actually move?
Yeah, this is crucial for clear communication, whether you're talking to a doctor, a trainer, or just understanding movement yourself. We use imaginary planes.
Planes, okay, like slicing through the body.
Exactly. First, the sagittal plane. It's a longitudinal plane running front to back that divides the head and torso into left and right parts, not necessarily equal halves, just left and right sections.
Okay, front to back slice.
Right. And all your flexion and extension movements happen in this plane. Think bending forward to touch your toes, that's flexion of the spine and hips. Or extending your arm straight back, all sagittal plane movement.
Got it. Flexion, extension, sagittal. What's next?
Next is the coronal plane, sometimes called the frontal plane. This is also a longitudinal plane, but it divides the body into front and back halves or parts.
Side to side slice, front and back.
You got it. Think about doing jumping jacks, waving your arm straight out to the side, or bringing your leg out away from your body. That's movement in the coronal plane.
Okay, and what movements are those called?
Here we see abduction and adduction.
Abduction and adduction, okay. And the third plane?
That's the transverse plane. This one is horizontal, perpendicular to those first two longitudinal planes. It divides the body into upper and lower halves or parts.
A horizontal slice, like cutting you in half at the waist?
Pretty much, yeah. And this is where all your rotation movements happen. Twisting your torso, turning your head side to side, rotating your arm inwards or outwards, all transverse plane.
Okay, sagittal for front back, coronal for side side, transverse for rotation.
Exactly. And just quickly, there's also the median plane, which is a specific sagittal plane right down the midline, dividing the body into equal right and left halves.
The midline one. Got it.
So to give you some concrete definitions for those movements we mentioned.
Yeah, please. Flexion.
Flexion generally means to bend a joint or decrease the angle between the bones, like bending your elbow, bringing your forearm closer to your upper arm.
Okay, decreasing the angle.
Conversely, extension generally means to straighten the joint or increase that angle, often moving the limb posterior or behind the midline. Straightening your elbow is extension.
Makes sense. And abduction, adduction.
Abduction. Abduct, takeaway, is to move a bone away from the midline of the body, lifting your arm straight out to the side.
Okay, away from midline.
And adduction, think add back, is to move a bone towards the midline, bringing that arm back down to your side.
Abduct away, adduct towards. Simple enough. Rotation.
Medial rotation, also called internal rotation, means rotating the front surface of a bone towards the midline, like turning your whole leg so your knee points inward.
Okay, towards midline rotation.
And lateral rotation, or external rotation, is rotating the front surface of a bone away from the midline, turning your whole leg so your knee points outward.
Got it. Are there other specific ones?
There are a few specific limb actions, yeah. Like pronation and supination, mostly referring to the forearm turning the palm down, pronation, or up, supination. But it can also refer to foot movement.
Oh, right. Pronation and supination of the foot, too.
Exactly. and then inversion and eversion for the foot, turning the sole inward, inversion or outward eversion, and lateral flexion is specific to the spine, like side bending.
Wow, okay, that's a lot of precise terms. And you mentioned directions earlier too. We also use crucial directional terms, yeah, like compass points on a map of your body. They add real precision.
Definitely need those.
So superior means above, towards the head end. Inferior means below, towards the feet.
Superior, inferior, up, down, got it.
Medial means closer to that midline we talked about, while lateral means further away from the midline.
And towards the middle, away from the middle.
Then there's proximal and distal, which relate to limbs mostly. Proximal is the near end of a bone or muscle closer to where the limb attaches to the body's core.
Closer to the trunk.
Right. And distal is the far end, away from the core. So your elbow is proximal to your wrist,
mm-hmm.
and your fingers are distal to your wrist.
Makes sense. Proximal near, distal far.
Yeah. And a couple more quick ones. Dorsal usually refers to the backside of something, like the top of your foot or the back of your hand. Ventral refers to the front or belly side.
Dorsal back, ventral front.
Okay. And finally, terms for movement patterns. Ipsilateral means occurring on the same side of the body.
Ipsilateral, same side.
Contralateral means occurring on the opposite side.
Contralateral, opposite side. Like walking arm swing is contralateral to leg
swing. Exactly. Right. Unilateral means one side only. Bilateral means both sides simultaneously. And reciprocal means both sides, but alternating, like walking again.
Wow. That's quite the vocabulary list.
Yeah.
But super useful for being precise.
Definitely. These terms aren't just academic. They're vital for describing an injury, understanding exercise instructions, everything really.
Absolutely. Now, if we connect all this anatomical language back to the actual doing, back to the physics, it's about how energy is created and managed within our own personal physics lab.
Okay, the forces involved.
Yeah, the fundamental forces in muscle actions. Muscles contract in three primary ways. First, isometric contraction.
Isometric. Iso meaning same. Metric meaning length.
You got it.
Yeah.
This is when a muscle contracts. It generates tension, but it doesn't actually change length against a force.
Like pushing a wall.
Exactly. Pushing against a concrete wall, your muscles are firing like crazy, working incredibly hard, but the wall isn't moving and your joint angle isn't changing. Or even just holding your body off the ground while you tie your shoe.
Ah, okay. Effort, but no visible movement of the joint itself.
Precisely. Then there's concentric contraction, meaning together, like it's shortening.
Shortening, okay.
This is where the muscle shortens as it contracts against a force. This happens when you're actively lifting something, like doing a bicep curl, lifting a weight towards your shoulder. Your biceps muscle shortens.
Going upstairs, picking up groceries.
All concentric work for the lifting muscles, yeah.
Yeah.
And third, we have eccentric contraction. This is often the trickiest one to grasp.
Okay, eccentric.
It means the muscle is contracting, generating force, but it's actually lengthening against that force, usually to control movement.
Lengthening while contracting, how does that work?
Think about slowly lowering that weight back down after the bicep curl. Your biceps is still active, controlling the descent, but it's lengthening as the elbow straightens.
Ah, okay, controlling the release.
Exactly, or walking downstairs. Your quadriceps muscles in your thighs are lengthening under tension to control your descent, preventing you from just crashing down with gravity.
Right. I feel that more going downstairs sometimes.
Many people do. It's often where muscle soreness comes from, but it's also crucial for building strength and, really importantly, for preventing injuries. Controlling that lengthening phase is key.
It's amazing how our muscles adapt to these different demands, holding, shortening, lengthening under load.
It really is.
And how they're built to generate these forces is equally fascinating. We basically have two main structural types of muscles, architecturally speaking.
Based on fiber direction.
Right. First, pinnate muscles. Their fibers run at an angle to the tendon, kind of like the barbs on a feather attaching to the quill, hence pinnate.
Angled fibers.
Yeah. This allows a large number of muscle fibers to pack into a smaller area and concentrate their pull on a single tendon.
More fibers pulling together.
Exactly. So generally, these are your strongest muscles designed for power and force production. Think of your big calf muscles, the gastrocnemius, or your gluteus maximus, or the rectus femoris in your thigh. Power muscles.
Got it. Pinnate equals power. What's the other?
The other main type is fusiform muscles. Fusi meaning spindle-shaped. Their fibers run more parallel to the length of the muscle and the tendon.
parallel fibers.
Right. They concentrate fewer fibers onto the tendon compared to pennant muscles of the same size.
So less force.
Generally, yes, they produce less maximal force than pennant muscles. But the trade-off is that they can usually shorten over a greater distance and contract more quickly.
Ah, speed and range again.
Exactly. Think of your biceps brachii in your arm, or the sartorius muscle running across your thigh, or the hamstrings, designed more for range and speed of movement rather than just brute force.
So it's another design choice, structure matching function. Power versus range and speed.
Perfectly put.
And underpinning all of this muscle action, all this movement, are fundamental physics principles. We can't ignore Sir Isaac Newton here.
Ah, yes, Newton's laws of motion, they apply inside us too.
Absolutely. Take Newton's first law, the law of inertia. It states that a body at rest stays at rest, and a body in motion stays in motion with the same speed and in the same direction, unless acted upon by an external force.
Right. Objects resist changes in motion.
Precisely. So when you're sitting still, you'll stay still until your muscles generate an internal force or an external force, like someone pushing you, gets you moving. And the greater your mass, the greater your inertia. It takes more force to start moving you and more force to stop you once you're moving.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the second law?
Newton's second law relates movement and force. Basically, it says that an object accelerates or changes its motion because a source makes it move. The acceleration is directly proportional to the force applied and inversely proportional to the object's mass.
ESMA, right?
ESMA, got it. More force equals more acceleration. More mass equals less acceleration for the same force.
Exactly. It dictates how quickly you can start, stop, or change direction based on the forces your muscles generate against your body's mass.
Okay. And the third law, the action-reaction one, Newton's third law. Opposite forces. This one is crucial for understanding locomotion. It states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Forces always come in pairs.
Equal and opposite reaction. How does that play out in the body?
Think about walking or running. As your foot pushes down and backward against the ground, that's the action.
Okay.
The ground simultaneously pushes up and forward against your foot with an equal force. That's the reaction. It's the ground reaction force that actually propels you forward.
So we push on the world and the world pushes back on us.
Exactly. Or jumping, you push down hard on the ground pushes back up equally hard, launching you upwards. This constant interplay of action-reaction forces is fundamental to all movement.
So if for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, does that mean our body is constantly in a kind of tug of war? And how does that relate to, say, maintaining balance?
It absolutely does mean that, and it's key to balance. That constant interplay of forces, that internal tug of war between muscle groups, between you and gravity, between you and the ground, that's precisely how we maintain balance and generate controlled movement without just collapsing or flying off in one direction. It's a dynamic equilibrium.
Wow. Okay. Beyond Newton's laws, there are a few other key biomechanical terms you mentioned we should probably touch on. Mass versus weight.
Right. Simple but important distinction. Mass is the amount of matter an object contains. It's constant wherever you are. Weight, on the other hand, is the measure of the force of gravity's pull on that mass. Your mass is the same on Earth and the Moon, but your weight is much less on the Moon because gravity is weaker.
Okay. Mass is stuff. Weight is gravity's pull on the stuff.
You got it. Then there's your center of gravity. Tsuyugi. This is the theoretical point where the entire mass of an object seems to be concentrated. It's the balance point.
The balance point. Is it always in the geometric center?
Not necessarily. Imagine a sphere that's half made of light cork and half made of heavy lead. Its geometric center is right in the middle, but its center of gravity, its cog, would be shifted way over towards the heavy lead side.
Ah, okay. It depends on how the mass is distributed.
Exactly. And your body's cog can shift, depending on your position, raise your arms, and your cog moves up slightly.
Right. And the line of gravity.
That's simply an imaginary vertical line dropping straight down from your center of gravity towards the center of the Earth. It represents the direction of gravity's pull on your body.
Okay. And the base of support.
That's the area underneath you that supports your body. When you're standing, it's the area covered by your feet and the space between them. A wider stance gives you a wider, more stable base of support.
Wider base, more stable. Makes sense. And torque. Sounds complicated.
It's just a turning force, basically. A force that causes rotation around an axis or pivot point, like our joints. Torque depends on both the amount of force applied and the distance that force is applied from the pivot point.
So it's not just how heavy something is, but how far away it is.
Exactly. Holding a heavy weight close to your body requires less torque from your muscles than holding that same weight out at arm's length. The longer the lever arm, the greater the torque generated by the weight and the harder your muscles have to work to counteract it.
Okay, torque is turning force affected by distance. Got it.
And just very briefly, it's worth knowing the types of forces our tissues actually experience. There's tension, which is a pulling or stretching force, like in a tendon. Compression, a pushing or squeezing force, like gravity pushing down on your vertebrae.
Okay, pull and push.
Then bending, which combines tension on one side and compression on the other. Shear, where forces act parallel to a surface like layers sliding over each other. And torsion, which is a twisting force. Often, tissues experience combined loading, a mix of these.
Tension, compression, bending, shear, torsion. Okay. Understanding those helps explain injuries, I guess.
Definitely. It helps us appreciate how resilient our tissues are, but also how they can fail if the forces become too great or are applied in the wrong way.
Right. Okay. This is fantastic groundwork. Now, here's where I think it gets really interesting for people listening.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting all these pieces, levers, planes, forces, muscle actions, to how you actually carry yourself every single day, our posture and alignment.
Ah, yes. The practical application.
Yeah.
This is where you can really start to see these principles in action in your own body.
Totally. Let's start with the spine. It isn't just a straight rod, right? It has specific curves and a set number of vertebrae in each section.
Correct. Those curves are crucial for shock absorption and movement. You have the cervical spine, your neck, with 7 vertebrae C1 to C7. It naturally has a slight forward or anterior curve.
7 in the neck, slight forward curve.
Okay. Then the thoracic spine, your mid and upper back, attached to your ribs. It has 12 vertebrae T1 to T12 and a slight backward or posterior curve. A kyphotic curve.
12 in the thoracic, slight backward curve.
Then the lumbar spine, your lower back. 5 vertebrae L1 to L5 with another slight forward anterior curve.
Mm.
A lordotic curve.
5 in the lumbar, forward curve again.
And below that, you have the sacrum, which is 5 vertebrae fused together into one triangular bone that connects to your pelvis. And finally, the coccyx, your tailbone. Usually 4 small fused vertebrae.
Okay, 7, 12, 5 plus the fused sacrum and coccyx. Got the map. So what's considered ideal alignment then?
Well, when we talk about ideal alignment in standing, physiotherapists often use a plumb line, literally a weight on a string, as a reference.
Okay.
Ideally, that plumb line, when viewed from the side, should hang so it passes slightly in front of your outer ankle bone, the lateral malleolus. That point is pretty consistent.
In front of the ankle bone. Okay.
And from there, ideally, it should travel up through roughly the midpoint of your knee, slightly behind the center of your hip joint, through the midpoint of your shoulder joint, and ideally through your earlobe. So your earlobe should be pretty much lined up vertically over the middle of your shoulder.
Ear over shoulder, shoulder over hip, hip over knee, slightly behind ankle. Okay, that's the ideal side view.
That's the general benchmark, yes.
So this raises an important question, as you said earlier. When our bodies deviate from this ideal alignment, what's actually happening beneath the surface? What are the implications?
Great question. These deviations often involve changes in those spinal curves or shifts away from that plumb line. For instance, lordosis isn't necessarily bad. We have natural lordotic curves, but excessive lordosis means too much inward curve, usually in the lumbar spine, and excessive sway back.
Okay, too much low back curve.
And kyphosis is an excessive outward or posterior curve, usually seen in the thoracic spine. A pronounced rounding of the upper back.
Too much upper back rounding.
Then there's the really common one, forward head posture. This is where your head sits significantly forward of that ideal plumb line, so your earlobe is way out in front of your shoulder midpoint.
Yeah, I see that a lot. What causes it?
It's often a combination of things. Maybe excessive extension in the upper cervical spine to keep the eyes level, combined with increased flexion or rounding down at the base of the neck and upper back around T1, C7. Muscle-wise, you often see tight neck extensor muscles at the back of the neck and tight sternocleidomastoid muscles at the front.
Okay.
While the deep neck flexors at the front might be weak, it's a classic imbalance pattern, often linked to prolonged screen time, text neck.
Right. And it can cause headaches, neck pain.
Absolutely. It puts a lot of strain on those structures.
Hmm.
And it's a cascading effect, isn't it? As you said, one small shift can create a ripple throughout the entire system.
Definitely. What about shoulder blades, the scapulae?
Scapula position is key, too. You might see winging scapula, where the inner border lifts away from the rib cage, often due to weakness in muscles like serratus anterior, or elevated scapula, where the whole shoulder blade sits too high, maybe due to overactive upper traps. Or even depressed scapula sitting too low. These affect shoulder mechanics significantly.
Wow. And the pelvis, you mentioned tilts earlier.
Precisely. Let's revisit that. An anteriorly tilted pelvis, where the front drops and the back lifts, isn't just about bone position. It reflects a dynamic muscular struggle.
A tug of war again.
Exactly. Typically, the muscles pulling it forward, their hip flexors at the front of the hip, and the erector spinae and maybe quadratus lumborum in the lower back become tight or overactive.
Okay, hip flexors and low back muscles tight.
And the muscles that should pull it back, the hamstrings at the back of the thigh, and the abdominal muscles, particularly the external obliques, often become lengthened and relatively weak or underactive.
Hamstrings and abs weak. Got it.
Conversely, with a posteriorly tilted pelvis, the flat back look where the tailbone tucks under, you often find the opposite pattern. Tight hamstrings and external obliques pulling down at the back.
Okay.
And lengthened or weak hip flexors and erector spinae at the front and lower back.
It's like a seesaw of muscle tension around the pelvis.
It really is.
Yeah.
And these imbalances don't just affect your standing posture. They impact how you walk, how you squat, how effectively you can use your core. They can contribute to lower back pain, hip issues, knee problems. It's all connected.
It really is. What about leg alignment below the pelvis? Things like knock knees or bow legs.
Yeah, those are common too. Knock knees, technically genu valgum, often involves the thigh bones, femurs being rotated outwards, the feet might be rolled inwards, supinated, knees hyperextended, and the result is the knees angle inwards, touching or knocking.
Okay, knees in.
And bow legs, genu varum, is often the opposite pattern. Thigh bones rotated inwards, feet rolled outwards, pronated, knees hyperextended, resulting in a gap or bowing between the knees.
Knees out. And these aren't just cosmetic either, right? They affect joint loading.
Hugely. They change how forces travel through the hip, knee, and ankle joints, potentially increasing stress on certain areas and contributing to pain or arthritis down the line. And briefly, we should mention scoliosis, which is a lateral or sideways curvature of the spine. That's a whole complex topic in itself.
Right, a side-to-side curve. Okay, so let's connect some of these postural deviations back to specific muscle imbalances, like that kyphotic, rounded upper back posture.
Okay, yeah. With kyphotic posture, you typically see tightness or overuse in muscles at the front of the chest, like the pectoralis major, and also the neck extensors at the back and the sternocleidomastoid at the front, pulling your head forward.
Okay, chest and some neck muscles tight. Which ones are weak?
The ones that get stretched out and weakened are often the muscles between the shoulder blades, like the rhomboids and middle trapezius, the upper back part of the erector spinae, and the deep neck flexors, but not the SCM. Remember, that one's often tight.
Ah, okay, so the muscles that pull the shoulders back and hold the upper back straight get weak.
Exactly. It's about restoring balance between these opposing groups.
And are there ideal patterns for how muscles should fire during movements?
Yes. Researchers have looked into ideal muscle firing sequences for common movements. For example, during hip extension, like lifting your legs straight back when lying on your stomach, ideally the sequence should be gluteus maximus fires first.
Okay, the main butt muscle.
Then hamstrings on the same side, then the erector spinae on the opposite side of the back, and finally the erector spinae on the same side. Deviations from this pattern can indicate muscle imbalances or compensation strategies.
Wow, that's specific.
It can be. Or for leg abduction, lifting the leg out to the side while lying on your side, ideally the gluteus medius side hip muscle fires first, then maybe tensor fasciae latae, another hip muscle, then the quadratus lumborum, low back muscle on the same side, and then the abdominal muscles might co-contract for stability.
Fascinating how coordinated it should be.
It highlights how interconnected the system is.
And you touched on this earlier, but how do our individual body proportions play into all this? Does having long legs or a short torso actually change how we move or what exercises feel like?
Oh, absolutely. It can make a huge difference in leverage and how movements feel. Someone with a relatively long torso and shorter legs, for instance, might find core exercises like the Pilates roll-up, where you curl up from lying down, significantly harder. They have more upper body weight to lift relative to the counterbalancing weight of their legs.
Ah, okay. More challenging leverage.
Whereas someone with a shorter torso and longer legs might find that same roll-up easier, but they might struggle more with exercises that involve holding straight legs up off the floor. Their longer leg levers create more torque for their abs to handle.
Right, so it's not just strength, it's physics based on your build.
Exactly. It underscores why understanding your own unique blueprint is so important and why there's no single perfect way to move or exercise that fits everyone. It truly highlights the individuality of our internal engineering.
That makes so much sense. And one last term here, supported pelvic position. What does that mean practically?
that often comes up in things like Pilates or core work. It generally means adjusting your pelvic tilt, usually by slightly flexing the lumbar spine, reducing the low back curve, just enough to feel a connection between your lower ribs and the front of your hips, engaging your deep abdominals without fully flattening your back necessarily. It's about finding stability.
Okay. Finding that core connection without forcing an unnatural position.
Precisely. It's about support and control.
Wow. Okay. What a journey through our internal engineering. We've covered a lot.
We really have.
You've now, hopefully, got the vocabulary and the blueprint to understand your own amazing machine a little better. From those intricate lever systems powering every reach and step, to the precise anatomical language describing your movements, and the biomechanical forces constantly shaping your posture.
It's truly incredible how it all works together. So dynamic, so adaptable.
It really is.
And, you know, this raises, I think, an important question for everyone listening. Knowing all this, thinking about levers and planes and posture, what one new aspect of your own movement or posture will you pay closer attention to today?
Ooh, good question.
Maybe it's noticing how your body acts as a third-class lever when you reach for your coffee mug. Or perhaps you'll become aware of a subtle shift in your pelvic tilt when you're sitting at your desk. And just consider for a moment which muscles might be tight or weak.
Yeah, just bringing some awareness to it.
Exactly. The real beauty isn't just knowing the terms, it's in applying this knowledge, tuning into that incredible constant conversation your body is having with gravity, with forces, with the world around it.
That's a fantastic thought to leave everyone with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into decoding your body's blueprint.
My pleasure. It's fascinating territory.
Keep exploring your own internal biomechanics, everyone, and we'll catch you next time.